And welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC 915 on a snowy Friday morning here in Studio A. Well, it's not snowing in Studio A yet. The roof is still holding up.
For now.
It's the Roundtable panel today. And boy, what a panel. Everybody was very intrepid and got into work, except one. David Soares, Albany County District Attorney, is here. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Nice to see you here. And communications consultant Joe Bonilla is also here. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
And also on the panel today is WAMC's Alan Shartok. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. And I have to admit, when they announced that the eastbound lanes on the I-90 were closed, that was it for me. And so here I am.
Okay, well, you're traveling west, I mean, on I-90, right?
Yeah, but you know, you never know who'll come over on the other side.
You make an excellent point.
Put another way, any excuse at a storm.
Well, you know, some of us were out shoveling very early in order to do our radio job. So.
Oh yeah, no, I know, Ray, and it's a great pleasure to have you with
us.
People have wanted to know how Joe's doing. He's doing great. He'll be fine. No problem. It's just a passing problem.
It's a passing problem. Well, that's very well put, sir, and thank you very much. The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. You can always write in and keep your letters brief if you can. Just hit us with a good thought and then move on. No links, no abbreviations, one email a day per customer. We do get a lot of emails here. panel@wamc.org is the email address. Well, I think if you are in the Albany area or in northeastern New York, you heard the news, and we are lucky to have the newsmaker on here today on this panel. So we might as well start with this. Albany County District Attorney David Soares says beginning next month, his office will decline to prosecute cases solely involving possession of less than 2 ounces of marijuana. You made the announcement yesterday, David. Tell us about that.
Well, since the beginning of June 1st of this year, we've been on tour throughout the county speaking with residents in places like Albany, Bethlehem, Bern, Knox, Westerlo, as well as Gilliland, speaking with our constituents, asking them about marijuana, but also engaging them on a level of, about prospective legislation and what's coming down the pike. The reality is that Canada has just gone to recreational. There are some 29 states right now that have either medicinal or recreational in one form or another. New York is in the process of engaging and having these discussions for prospective legislation. And if we're going to be going in that direction, which I'm 100% sure that we are, it raises the question about whether we can ethically just continue to prosecute people who are currently in the system. And so why engage in all of this now only to come back perhaps a year from now to undo what we're doing? And so what we did was made an announcement yesterday about we are declining prosecution for people who are using. That would be a B misdemeanor under 2 ounces, as well as possession as violations.
And you have go ahead, Alan.
We just heard Alice Green, somebody we all respect a great deal, saying that the burden of marijuana prosecutions, at least this is what I heard her say, I thought, fell heavily on the African-American community. Can you comment on that, David?
That's true. There's a disproportionality of enforcement on people of color in certain communities. And that is, you know, it's largely due to the fact that the police receive the most calls for service. And so many of the what I would call illegal franchises are established in communities of color. So in addition, Alan, in addition to the issue of declining prosecution on these cases, I am trying to raise awareness as well about what this state does with resources. We're talking right now as an illicit economy. We're a $4 billion illicit economy right now. And so it has the potential to be an $8 billion legal economy. And so the question then becomes, what do you do with the taxes and what do you do with you know, the creation and formation of these industries? There's got to be a benefit to these communities that have historically been prosecuted, where people like that begin to experience the rewards of now, you know, recreational, legal recreational usage and market regulation.
Joe. As Arlo would say, not only that, that's what he says all the time, there is another issue, and that is we are now in the process of reforming criminal justice to the point where we recognize that too many people are in prison, and often there too many people are of color.
Yeah, that's true. And the reality is, again, with so many, and I've been saying this now for the better part of close to 20 years, so many of the illicit economies exist in communities of color. And so you can't tiptoe around the fringes of reform. In other words, you can't continue to come up every year, look for reduction in sentencing, prison reform, and let that be that. We've got to do something to create economies in these communities so that you can destroy the illicit economy by replacing the illicit economy with true economic opportunities for people who live in these communities. And so this is a two-pronged process. It starts by looking at ways that we can improve the criminal justice system by engaging in more alternatives to incarceration. We've been doing restorative justice practices in this community now for 20 years. My office, we include restorative justice not only at the misdemeanor level, but also at the felony level. We've been engaging in diversion before they called it diversion. And it's something that we're very proud of. But at the same time, you know, we don't see the difference and the meaningful impact in the communities because we don't have the investments that follow all of the reform measures.
Could you define for many of us what restorative justice actually means?
Well, restorative justice is, I'll tell you this, it was funny that some 16 years ago, I was told, because I was trying to create a restorative justice panel in Albany to deal with a lot of our lower level offenses, and I was told, because this had been something that had taken such a strong foothold in Vermont, I was told that it wouldn't work in an urban center, with the words urban being in quotes. We took that on, made it work here, and it's a process whereby we take young people away from the criminal justice system and we put them in front of a group of community members, and community members work with these young people to try to resolve whatever the issues that are that these young people have been arrested for. And we've diverted thousands of people from the criminal justice system, and I was very happy last year to announce that we were doing the same thing when the issues of raise the age when the debates were heated. Many of the studies that indicate that kids from 16 to 24 have not fully developed their brains yet, and I will agree with some of those studies to some extent. So we've looked at all of the nonviolent offenses. Offenses that do not involve weapons, and if you're 16 and 20 to 24, most of those cases are now being diverted to what we call a diversion board. And so it's not that raise the age, you know, it's not that we were opposed to raise the age, we just didn't think that raise the age went far enough, and that's now what we're practicing in Albany County.
Now, Ray, I know that I'm hogging the questioning here,
yes.
but I have one more question, and that is, considering that President Trump has now criticized Hannity for asking him softball questions, I wanted to ask at least one harder question, and that is, David, what happens when you get somebody who crashes his car into somebody and there's, you know, the smell of marijuana around?
Well, one of the things that we announced yesterday was that while we are taking an alternative posture with respect to possession, we are taking a much more aggressive approach when it comes to people who are operating under the influence of drugs. And so those cases will be handled differently now. We'll apply very strict scrutiny to those. And we'll also be applying very strict scrutiny to people who are smoking in public or smoking in front of children, because those are the areas that I don't think that you can go easy on. Our approach
is
tough and smart.
Do we have the test, David? In other words, can we test that somebody we know about alcohol? You know, you have to get an alcohol test on the spot. But what about marijuana?
There are tests. There are tests that we have increased our investment in providing greater training for law enforcement so that they could become drug recognition experts. That's certainly something that, as a president of the DA's Association, we are going to be aggressively advocating for, to have more resources being provided to local police departments so that they can train their personnel on advanced roadside safety examinations, as well as becoming drug recognition experts.
So that's the royal we you were using just now, right?
Yes.
Okay. Joe Bonilla.
Well, certainly I applaud your office's policy change. It's well overdue. You know, the one thing we have to look at is, you know, here in New York State, as we now have one party control with the governor's office, the assembly, and the Senate, recreational marijuana is going to be one of those top tier issues coming up in the session. But obviously the other part of legalization of recreational marijuana is coming down to financial and banking controls with that. And certainly that's one of the issues, I think, in terms of growth of the industry, it's more of an issue. So I guess, David, can you speak to more the financial implications of legalization and the recreational aspect of it?
So, you know, one of the areas that I would say one of the issues that people are looking forward to, and I've heard in different spaces, is the fact that, you know, by market regulation, decriminalization, you're going to see less people of color being prosecuted and put in jail. Studies in Colorado have very different results, and here's the reason why. When they passed, when they legalized marijuana, put it into the Constitution, they created two separate regulatory bodies, one for the rec and one for the medical marijuana. With all of these different regulations, what it did was it worked really against the same people that were being arrested because they fell out of all of those categories. Right. And so with the excess growth and the excess marijuana flowing in the state of Colorado, a lot of that went through a back door that not only created a much larger black market, it's a much more dangerous black market. And it's resulted in seeing more minorities involved in criminal justice instead of less. Mm. If we're going to go down this path, you must create opportunities for employment, opportunities in the whether it's the chain of production, wherever it is along the lines that people in communities like this can have those opportunities, you have to do this, or else all you're doing is you're expanding your black markets and you're going to expand the presence of law enforcement in these communities.
Well, I think to that too, I had a good friend of mine who went out to Oregon. Actually, he was one of these managers of these recreational marijuana stores. And the issue obviously came down to the federal side in terms of banking. They would have armored trucks come through because of all the cash. So certainly for a community that would impact it, you know, obviously if you have armored trucks going by, if you have, you know, basically this, you know, a massive amount of cash being handled, you know, certainly, you know, for police resources and obviously for your office too, I mean, that could also be an issue as well.
Oh, you know, I've always said that in Albany I haven't had a prosecution where two people who were smoking marijuana were assaulting one another. We've just not had that. But the collateral crimes that are attendant with this economy is you have young people who are out there robbing weed houses, and they're robbing weed houses with weapons, and they're coming into these houses with people who also have weapons to protect stashes. And so there's a lot of violence that surrounds the actual marketplace of marijuana. And unless the federal government does something to ease the banking regulations where these industries can now begin to use, and in fact, in Colorado, they're using credit unions. But credit unions they're taking on a whole lot of risk. Unless you're doing something to protect the industry as well, you're going to see, you know, the kind of violence that I think we're seeing right now.
All right, we have to take a break here. Albany County District Attorney David Soares is here discussing his announcement yesterday that effective December 1st, The Albany County District Attorney's Office will not prosecute cases solely involving possession of less than 2 ounces of marijuana. Alan Shartok is on the panel today. Joe Bonilla and the aforementioned David Soares. You can write to us at panel@wamc.org. Again, try to keep the letters concise, one a day. Give us a good thought, and we'll try to get it on the air. panel@wamc.org. We will take a quick break for news, and then we'll be back with more. Welcome back to the Roundtable. If you are on the road, I hope you are taking it slowly today. It is, you know, the roads are not so great. We made it in here on the panel. Joe Bonilla is here, and he tweeted last night that we would be here, and so, you know, he was late, and I was afraid.
Oh, stop it.
I was afraid he wasn't going to make it.
I just love it when Joe plays the piano like that.
Oh, absolutely.
Into the
yeah.
show. It's, yeah. That's beautiful.
He's like John Tesh, really. David Soares is here, Albany County District Attorney, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. David Soares, we had been speaking in the first half hour of the program about your announcement yesterday regarding declining to prosecute cases involving 2 ounces or less of pot starting December 1st. And my question, my interest, one, is the discussions among staff and experts that led you to this decision. And number two, was there any pushback among law enforcement people in this county who said, hey, wait a minute, the law's the law, man?
Well, first of all, I think you're always going to get pushback from a variety of different audiences. And I don't want to create the illusion here that when we went around town touring in the county that everyone was in favor of decriminalization or legalization. Quite the contrary. I think the vast majority of the people that we spoke with, as well as the people who went on to our website and did the poll, they were in favor of a policy change. As I've said, and the conversations that I've been having, is that New York is going in this direction. You have to understand that in almost 20 years of being in this business, we've seen marijuana come to our community from places like the Native American reservations here in our state, from Canada, from Arizona. That was 2007, 2008 to 2011. We now are surrounded by states who are either engaging in recreational or medicinal. So from Canada to Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, we're surrounded by it. So New York is eventually going to get on board. I think they're going to do it this year. But again, you have to ask yourself, as a person who's involved in law enforcement and criminal justice, can we really look at ourselves in the face and say, okay, I'm going to prosecute the 1,042 cases that are going to be coming in for calendar year 2018, knowing that we have governors and legislators who are conducting hearings all over the state in discussing there's an ethical and moral issue there. The other ethical and moral issue that we've got to deal with as a state is this. Are we seriously going to allow people on Wall Street to deliver these franchises to towns all over New York State and be rewarded for it when we have been for the last 30, 40 years prosecuting people from different communities for engaging in the same thing?
Alan Shartok.
Well, it all sounds very reasonable to me. I'm trying to think of all of the answers. You know, we were getting mail saying, come on, Alan, why aren't you asking about heroin use? You know, why are you asking about... Why are you asking about marijuana? Because marijuana is on the table right now.
Well, so, the heroin use issue is critical, Alan. As a matter of fact, what went into our deliberations was, in fact, the fact that heroin and fentanyl, that is where the war needs to be waged right now. Right. When I say war, I don't mean just by prosecutors. I'm talking about a combination of law enforcement and the public health system coming together to take this issue on, because people are, in fact, dying every single day in our communities. And we can't focus any longer on the low-level, nonviolent, recreational use of marijuana and divert those resources from, you know, the attention that we have to pay right now to fentanyl and heroin.
Alan, if you have no objection, we've got a couple of letters here that are pertinent to our...
Absolutely no objection.
All right, sir, then so move. This is from Otis in Beckett. Isn't allowing widespread commercial marijuana sales in communities where arrests were more prevalent kind of like providing alcohol to alcoholics?
I don't agree with that at all. No. We're talking about an industry right now that is a robust and thriving industry, and it's underground now. It's an illicit economy right now.
This one is from William. By what right does the DA get to pick and choose what laws will be enforced? Does another DA get to choose not to prosecute prostitution because it is an illicit economy? He is placing himself above the law, and he is usurping the legislature. If he wants to change the law, run for the Assembly or Senate. But as DA, he should be upholding the laws enacted by the people of the state of New York. And that's from William.
William, you should perhaps look into the law a little bit more and understand that you have prosecutorial discretion, and you can exercise prosecutorial discretion to decide what cases you prosecute and what cases you do not prosecute. And as a matter of fact, right now, many jurisdictions, including Albany County, we are looking at prostitution differently because we now understand that prostitution is about human trafficking, and many of the people that you were out there calling prostitutes are, in fact, victims of crime.
All right, this one came in from Deborah. We need to replace the word recreational with adult use of marijuana. We shouldn't give the impression that it is an activity without implications or ramifications. People should not drive under the influence or go to school or work under the influence, et cetera. And that's from Deborah.
And
I think that's a very good letter.
Deborah's 1,000% correct, and I will work to improve my language.
You went to Colorado in part of your fact-finding, and you learned quite a bit about the way this was panning out now. It's been about a year now since it's illegal. How is law enforcement dealing with the consequences?
Well, you know, first of all, trained law enforcement, they're always going to, I think, deal with these issues appropriately. However, it's the conflation and the confusion surrounding the laws in Colorado that make it almost impossible for the members of law enforcement out there to enforce. For example, you have what is the functional equivalent of the tax department that oversees the market regulation, adult use. I don't want to use the word recreation anymore. But then you have the health department that oversees the medicinal, and so they've gone through a whole process of amendments, and sometimes those amendments they run contradictory to one another, and so it makes for very confusing enforcement. Those are the kind of things that they're trying to work out, but it's also the kind of thing that I want to make sure our legislators understand so that we're not running into the same issues 2 years from now, 3 years from now here in the state of New York.
I want to go back, if I can, Ray, two letters ago, because I think, you know, there is an argument to be made here, which will get people angry, that what David Soares is doing here is more representative of what the people are feeling than what the legislature is doing. I mean, you know, we have a gerrymandered districts, we have a corrupt legislature that wants to do business on the outside and all the rest of it. David went and he asked everybody. There was polling done and the rest of it. So I do think an argument could be made, although there will be those who object to it, that to compare what he's doing to the legislature is really misplaced.
Yeah, polling, though. I mean, if they polled people during Prohibition, hey, should we have booze?
Yeah.
A lot of people would say, yeah, we should have booze.
But you would have said it.
Yes, I would have said it. In fact, I wish I had some right now.
Yeah, I get it.
But the question for David is, then in Prohibition, would district attorneys say, well, we're going to look the other way on this?
I don't know that district attorneys would say we're going to look away from this. And I don't know that during the Prohibition era, people had as much information, studies and results of those studies that made those prosecutors more informed. As a matter of fact, being a prosecutor today in 2018, as opposed to any time in the past, we have to be much more aware of so many different issues, you know, domestic violence. We don't prosecute domestic violence like we used to prosecute domestic violence 20 years ago. We treat, you know, human trafficking differently today because we're much more informed. On this issue of marijuana, you know, you're talking about 29 states, the states that are the most populated in our country, where studies after studies after studies have been done. And I've met people personally while I was on tour who, who need, you know, this medicine. And I'm speaking just specifically now about the medicinal benefits. But, you know, on the other side, again, with the exception of the traffickers, you know, this is a product that has not harmed people and has not been the threat to public safety that alcohol has. But here we are with this fundamental hypocrisy about alcohol and this other product.
All right. Tell you what, Alan and Joe and David, let's read two more letters here, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll shift gears. And there's a recount going on. It's a hand recount. We'll
okay, but before we do, very quickly, I want to say that when we get to work very early in the morning, 4 o'clock sometimes, we're often approached by human traffickers. In other words, we're often approached by women who are prostitutes. And yet, you know, David, and maybe we can come back and talk about this, we know that there's often a very muscular pimp standing around there ready to beat your brains out, and that makes it – that is not quite a victimless crime.
It, you know, and that's the reason why we take such a different approach to it now, because of our level of understanding of the dynamics of that industry. Mm-hmm. And we know that so many people are not out there because of they want to be out there. They're out there because there's force
the
being leveraged against
yeah,
them.
Yeah, the people beat them up. Yep, yep.
This one came in from Richard. Marijuana reform is critical because those arrested are disproportionately non-white, while the use of marijuana is just as prevalent among whites as it is among any other population. I also want to compliment Dr. Shartok on his uncompromising hardball questions. Let no one compare him with Sean Hannity. That's from Richard. This one is from Ricky. Hi, panel. Alan was asking about marijuana testing for driving, but I did not hear him ask about heroin or cocaine or prescription pills. Yeah. Weed is not the enemy some people make it out to be. I would bet you know a person or persons who use pot. And that is from Ricky. Last one here, and then we'll take a break. This one is from Kevin. No, it's not. It's not this question. Oh, the question is from Kevin in Melrose, but it is for David. In David's opinion, how has Mueller handled the investigation into Russian collusion? Anything that has struck out to you that could give us more insight into a possible outcome? Would he have wrapped it up by now if there was no collusion?
His handling of this case has been nothing short of brilliant. And I'll say this. I know nothing about his handling of the case. What I do know is that we know nothing about the case.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself, to me, demonstrates how brilliant these people are. How professional these people are, and the level of trust that exists within each of them in that environment, not to have anything out there leaking, and
it's
to just
very rare.
Out.
It is incredibly rare,
and it's I think people fail to appreciate the magnitude of this case, the paperwork, the subpoenas, the returns that are coming in from international banks, and the amount of work it takes to sift through everything in order to develop, you know, the indictments that have already. Gone forward. So this work is nothing short of brilliant as far as I'm concerned.
Alan Shartok, David Soares, and Joe Bonilla are on the panel. You can join in by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. We'll take a quick break and then we'll talk about the recount. All right, enough of the disturbing bumper music. Thank you, Mike Bowen, the engineer. It's the roundtable panel. It's 9:48. David Soares is giving you the thumbs up. I think that's a thumb. The panel,
what else could it be?
Well, the panel consists of Alan Shartok, David Soares, and Joe Bonilla. And you at home certainly can email us if you wish. And if it's good, we'll read it. panel@wamc.org. A Florida judge is rejecting a challenge to the rules that will be used in a hand recount in the state's contentious U.S. Senate race. U.S. District Judge Mark Walker late Thursday ruled against Senator Bill Nelson and Democrats in another one of the lawsuits surrounding the recount. During the hand recount, election officials look at just the ballots that weren't recorded by voting machines. Under state law, voters must use only approved markings or their ballot is disqualified, and they cannot simply cross out a mistaken vote, but must explain in writing why they did so. The lawsuit contended that has a discriminatory effect on non-native English speakers and illiterate voters. Walker found the rules were reasonable and constitutional. Florida counties must finish the hand recount by Sunday. Alan, I know you have a strong opinion about this.
Well, you know, it's not so much a strong opinion as it is a frustration that our electoral system is being manipulated, obviously. You know, you want to, we have such a thing called, and David will be familiar with this, judge shopping. You go to the judge Who you think will give you the best break? Who appointed her? Republicans or Democrats? That possibility. You know, I've thought from the very beginning the Democrats are going to lose these races. Whether or not the fix was in, I don't know. But I admire them for taking it all the way, and we'll see. Obviously, the governor one is now off the table. So now we have the Senate, and that one is the one that offers the most promise to the Democrats. But I still have a gut feeling it's for naught.
Well, I mean, part of the issue here is that every single cycle we have the same issue with Florida. And one of the things that is a note is that, you know, here in New York State, you know, obviously we have a Scantron ballot, and that's universal throughout, you know, each of the 62 counties. In Florida, they have varying different ballots. You know, in Broward County, you have a Scantron. In Palm Beach, you still have a voting machine. So going through this entire manual recount process, and hopefully, you know, it will come down to something in the near future in terms of a real reform effort in Florida. But when it comes down to this, is if Bill Nelson can eke this out, what momentum that will have for Democrats going into next year?
Well, yeah, and if a bird flew through the room, you know, that would be unusual. nevertheless, one has only got to think that the people in power will not allow a reform of the kind you are suggesting. So if the Republicans win in every one of these situations, hanging chads and on, why in the world? What's the incentive for them to change? They're not gonna. It's that simple.
Well, I agree with you, Alan, and I think we've touched on this subject in previous conversations, because it seems that whichever party is in power, there is a resistance to change anything in the process to going about obtaining that power. And I will say this, and I might be in the minority here, but, you know, when we're having these discussions against the backdrop of the hacking that took place, not only with the National Democratic committees, but, as you know, with WikiLeaks, and you're talking about Facebook, you know, I'm okay with the fact that jurisdictions are allowed to have their own process, because the moment we go through some kind of universal process where we want to create this wonderful national system, that is going to be subject to hacking, as well as I don't believe there's enough security in place to prevent, you know, greater abuses from taking place.
And
so I'm just going to be a little patient and allow these people to count those chats.
That's right. And somebody suggested on the roundtable yesterday, we have a national system. Oh, yeah, well, that's fine until that national system is, for example, prescribed by Donald Trump. And I don't think it's going to turn out well. So there's something to be said about allowing these laboratories of democracy, otherwise known as the states, to do it, even if some of them do it badly. I want to talk a little bit, if I can, Ray. You as the moderator
yes.
will have to decide.
All right. Go ahead. That's fine.
Is New York State, you know, for years, we have a gerrymander in New York State. The assembly gerrymanders like crazy. They draw their own districts, and they have their computers draw the districts. It's undemocratic. The Republicans have certainly done it. That's how they stayed in power, you know, all of this time. So we don't have to go point the finger at just Florida for doing it. You can see that these politicians will do whatever is best for them in order to stay in power. And that's why I find it so interesting, now that the Senate is gone Democratic, to see whether some of the hypocrites in the Assembly will do it according to their ethical standards, what they've always said they would do, or whether they'll say, and goodbye.
And there was silence.
Did you get that?
Yes. Well, no, we got that. You came through loud and clear. I think there's a certain amount of processing that is being done by our panelists.
No, you know, it's profound, because I think, you know, it's frustrating to see the most precious franchise that we have in this country being manipulated in the ways that they're manipulated. But I also
think it's more
than
troubling. It's disgusting.
It's disgusting. But I also think that, you know, moments like this, when the world is when I say the world, I mean our country, when we're watching Florida, you know, this is when we should be talking about the importance of voting. You know, the major policies, specifically in the Senate, are going to be developed over the course of the next 2 years that are going to be developed based upon the results of Florida. So for those people that stayed home that didn't think that their votes counted, I mean, take a look. We've had so many elections in this country in the last 10 years where the numbers are so close that we should be driving the point home. You know, it's important to vote. But not only is it important to vote, it's also important to invest in the infrastructure that makes it easier for people to exercise that precious franchise.
But I think going back to, obviously, this quote-unquote national system, we still have to have a minimum threshold of what a vote actually could be. I mean, in Bay County in Florida, you have people voting by fax, by email, because obviously it was hit by the hurricane. So there has to be something that can make it easier for folks, but still valid at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the more interesting stories on NPR this morning was the invalidation of some of these ballots, because when kids sign up when they're 18 years old, didn't you find this fascinating? They have a different signature, which is the way that you decide whether these are honest ballots, these absentee ballots, than they have when they're mature adults.
Well, that's the most, that to me is the most depressing and frustrating thing to have learned, that someone who just shows up to work and maybe they didn't have their cup of coffee, maybe they're not in a good mood, they're going to be looking at these ballots and they're going to make these haphazard decisions as to who can exercise the franchise and who can't. And there's no means, there's no structure, there's no definition, there's no expertise associated with how those decisions are made.
Well, yeah. I mean, and also going back to the ballot design too, I mean, you look at the difference between Palm Beach and Broward. You know, you had the Senate. The Senate election was on the left-hand side on the bottom where it looked like it was a disclosure, you know? So there has to be some sort of, basically, the minimum threshold guidelines.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, not only are there millions of dollars, you know, being spent to dissuade people from exercising their franchise, but then there's all sorts of other manipulation that takes place in the form of the structure of a ballot.
Right.
And the times that, you know, polling centers are going to open early, and now requirements for ID, all sorts of things. I mean, we just have to wake up as a country, as citizens, and do our very best to continue to promote the use and the exercise of this franchise.
All right, we're going to take a break here, Alan. You get the last word, and then we will break for news.
Last word is, you would expect that the franchise would be quite a physique after it had been so exercised.
The email address here is panel at WAMC. He's very clever. You know, he should work from home more often.
There you go.
Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Terrapin Restaurant, serving lunch and dinner 7 days a week in a historic renovated church building in the heart of Rhinebeck Village. TerrapinRestaurant.com. And Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years, from digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more. ParadiseCopies.com.
You know, one of the great things about being a guest host of this show is you don't always go with the flow very well. So we're not going to break for news at this particular time. We're going to wait a couple of more minutes.
Oh, who may be at the phone?
We can barely hear you. Oh, Alan's on the phone. That's why. All right, turn your microphone off, sir. We can hear you.
We are joined
today by David Soares, Albany County District Attorney and Communications Consultant Joe Bonilla. You, of course, can join us via email. And we did get an email from Richard. Who writes, counting, within a few hours, we can sort through millions of lottery tickets with multiple choices of six numbers each and know if and where a winning ticket has been sold, even down to the particular convenience store, and yet we are struggling to tally voting ballots, priorities, and why. And then, parentheses, a sinister answer comes to mind. That is from Richard.
Well, it's similar to ATMs. I mean, you don't hear about ATMs, you're having issues about, you know, how much money you want out of the ATM, and there's millions of ATMs across the country, and that's the issue that we have across the country. No matter what state you're in, no matter what county, there has to be that minimum threshold.
And Meredith wrote, when talking about the small chance that Democrats will win the Florida Senate recount, Alan said the recount will be all for naught. Counting all votes and ensuring every voice is heard cannot be said to be worthless, even if the outcome is not what you desired. And that's from Meredith.
Wait. I want to respond.
Oh, boy.
Wait. I want to respond to that. I thought it was a good exercise. I'm glad they're doing it. I think every vote should be counted. Don't put words into my mouth or join the lumped proletariat.
Ouch, David.
That was a
burn.
Yeah. Got you, Meredith.
Okay. all right. This one's from Michael. Mr. Soros, I believe this is supposed to be Mr. Soros for president. We need an intelligent person in that office. He is so capable and would make a great executive. And that's
I'd take either of them.
Soros or Soros?
Well, yeah. Well, I was born in one of those S hole countries, so
oh yeah, you can't go. Oh,
no, he said S. Just to be clear,
S.
S. Yeah.
All right. So you guys talk for a moment, and I'm going to see if I can get some direction in there about what we should do.
Yeah, we have a little bit of a problem here, but we'll talk among ourselves.
Okay. No,
you know, I want to stay on the Florida issue for a moment here because I think that nationally, what we've done is focus so much on Georgia and Florida that we've completely failed to accept the fact that positive things happen for Democrats and progressives, you know, during this past cycle.
Okay. All right. Now we're going to wrap it up. And I hate to interrupt all of you, but we'll take a break here. It is the top of the hour. It's a little discombobulated. You'll see why momentarily.
Yeah,
Alan Chartok,
big surprise.
David Soros and Joe Bonilla are here. It's the Roundtable. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable, 10:01 on a snowy Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, and we had a little confusion here in Studio A, and that is because we have, much like Bob Hope used to walk on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, we have a guest here on the line.
A walk-on.
And we'd like to welcome the governor of the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo. Good morning, Governor.
Thank you for having me. I love that. Bob Hope and Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
Who's Johnny Carson?
I don't know. Some old guy. You're right, on, right. And Alan wants to talk to you, sir.
Yeah.
I think Alan is Johnny Carson.
No, you're right.
Yeah. That's. I only wish, because then I'd have some money. I wanted to ask you a question, Governor. You're getting quite beaten up in some of the press, like the New York Times, for having made this deal with Amazon and the world's richest man to come to New York. Some people are saying that the deal is worth almost $4.2 billion. That's a lot of money for the world's richest man. How do you plead?
I plead frustration. The New York Times editorial, you know, that's a little bit the Wizard of Oz, right? His great booming voice, and then there winds up this little man behind the curtain.
Uh-oh.
They have some great people on the editorial board, but I think it depends on who writes the editorial, because it comes down to individuals and their opinions. The Amazon deal, this was a national competition that went on for much fanfare. Everybody was competing for it. 54 states, provinces, cities, everyone. They were offering to rename the city. This is the largest single economic development program, right? 25,000 jobs.
Right.
And states were making outrageous bids. Many states and cities made larger bids than ours. Now,
really? Is that
yes.
More than $4.2 billion?
Oh, you had New Jersey offered six.
Wow.
You had states with much lower tax rates offering more. So that's a double benefit, right? Because their tax rate is less, and they were offering a greater incentive against the lower tax rate. We had advantages that they didn't have. But we didn't win this on the numbers. Our bid was not as high. We have other advantages because New York is New York, he says as an arrogant New Yorker. But also, their premise is wrong. We're spending money. No, we're not spending money. What it comes down to is if they came here, we would make, by our current tax structure, about $1 billion a year in revenue by our current tax structure. In the competition, we're competing against states that have no income tax, no corporate tax. So that $1 billion is just the price of admission to New York for them.
But wouldn't we be – I'm sorry, Governor, but wouldn't we be getting that money? In other words, we say, okay, we'll forgive you this, we'll forgive you that. That's money that would come into our coffers, except that we're excusing it. Not only that, but then there's a lot of people who are ticked off that the regular way of doing this kind of stuff, you know, the local real estate permitters and everybody else are being cut out of the deal so that, you know, behind closed doors, you guys could make a marriage here.
Yeah, but let's stay on point one. If 25,000 people move to New York, average job salary $150,000, you will make $1 billion. If they don't come to New York, you get zero. We say, our quote-unquote incentive is, instead of giving us $1 billion a year, give us $900 million, $100 less. Okay? We win on that basis. So our current tax structure would call for $1 billion. They're going to give us $900 million instead. And they come. Now, people say, oh, you spent $100. No, we didn't spend $100. We made $900. If they don't come, Alan, we get nothing.
But what if, just what if, you're displacing a lot of people? There was supposed to be affordable housing being built there. What if the social consequences in both Arlington and New York are negative? People have to move, you know, these guys who really don't need $4.2 billion one way or the other, no matter how you define it, are getting it.
No, you could say, you could have said early on, I'm not interested in you coming here. Keep your 25,000 jobs. Keep your input in the tech center. Go somewhere else. Go to Florida. Nobody said that. Nobody. As a matter of fact, the same politicians who now are responding to nervous neighbors, they all signed a letter supporting the application for Long Island City. And one is not the enemy of the other. This is building on currently basically vacant, underused space.
Well, could it be used for something else, Governor?
Sure.
Like affordable housing?
Sure. Now you just need the money to build the affordable housing. The sensible conclusion is, A, this is $900 million that you didn't have before. Now, you want to talk about how to use the revenue? That's a fine conversation. But, Alan, they displaced nobody. You're $900 million ahead of where you were. You have a big tech sector leader, $150,000 jobs. They're doing all sorts of good things for the communities. They're working with the local public housing authority. You're going to get a new school built, and you're getting $900 million.
Well, it cost you
$100. No, it didn't cost us $100. We make $900. And if we didn't offer them any break from one of the highest tax states in the country, they would have gone somewhere else. And by the way, if they had gone somewhere else, the editorials would have said, oh, my God, I can't believe we lost. Welcome to my business, Al.
But yes, and I'm glad I'm not in it. But there is a question to me as to the world's one of the world's most crowded cities, expensive cities, and it's going to get more expensive and the housing stock is going to get more rare. How do we answer that?
Use part of the $900 million to build affordable housing. There's virtually nothing on this site. I'm an old Queens boy. This was Long Island City. It's old factory site, basically. And by the way, this site has been sitting there for decades. It's part of what's called the Queens West Project, which is development of the Queens waterfront. My father started Queens West. It was supposed to be mixed use, commercial and residential. There has been no commercial development. There has been residential, but no commercial. So it was always supposed to be mixed use.
So what about the rest of the city, Governor? What about an apartment that New York used to be $2,000 a month, might be $5,000 a month because, you know, there's so little of it and there are so many new people coming in.
Well, you want jobs coming in, right? The economy is what pulls the train. You want people coming in and paying taxes so you can do good things. For anyone to say, we don't want 25,000 tech jobs that pay $150,000. By the way, nobody says that because we just spent a year with this heated competition where everybody was competing for this. This was the prize. All of our upstate cities were competing. Every state virtually was competing. Nobody says no to 25,000 high-tech jobs. Now, it annoys people that Bezos, an important corporation, should get any reduction from our tax rate. They would have gone somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's called the market. And if our taxes are 10% in New York City, and they can go to Texas and pay zero, they go to Texas.
So why didn't they do it?
They go to Florida.
Well, you know, they want to come to New York because it's New York. They want to come to Arlington because it's Washington. I get that. But maybe they would have been better. New Yorkers would have been better off if they did go to Texas. How's that for a spurious argument?
That's a spurious argument. And you lose $900 million. And the site that has sat vacant for decades continues to sit vacant. And one of the leaders in the tech economy goes somewhere else.
Okay.
By the way, that's, you know, that is the problem that we have faced, right, is loss of jobs to other parts of the country.
We have. Let's go to a different place, if we may. It's snowing outside.
Yes.
Are you happy with the way in which the city, which came to a gridlock, we don't know why, and much of upstate, over five-inch snowstorm? What's going on?
Well,
you're responsible for that.
Upstate, the buck stops on my desk for everything. Lightning, tornadoes, hurricanes.
Right. As it should.
Making $900 million. The upstate, it's a different reality than what happened like in New Jersey and New York City, where I think they got hit harder than they were expecting. We haven't had significant issues upstate beyond the average fender benders, et cetera, that you would have. We were ahead of this. You know, unfortunately, Alan, no governor has had the experience dealing with emergencies that I have had for two reasons. First, I did the emergency work when I was on the federal side at Department of Housing and Urban Development. I worked on emergency response around the country, around the world. But no governor has had the number of emergencies that I've had. We didn't have tornadoes, floods, Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. This never happened before. So I came with experience, but I've gotten a lot more than I would like. And that's why when people argue against climate change, 500-year floods, yeah, except they happen six times a year. But we have the equipment, we have the training, and I'm satisfied with what we did upstate. New York City, New Jersey, the snowfall was higher than predicted. And I'm not really sure about I'm in Albany, so I don't really know firsthand how it was in the city. I know my brother was lamenting about it on TV last night. But
Is that a shot?
That was not a shot. That was a factual statement. He and okay. Don Lemon were lamenting about the weather. He laments.
Sounded like a shot.
No, he likes to. He's a lamenter. My brother is a lamenter, Alan. You know Chris a long time. He is a. But really, it was Don who was complaining more about it. But I think the snowfall was higher in Jersey and New York City than they were anticipating, and I think it came down faster.
Okay, let's change the subject because I don't have you forever, that's for sure, and we're very delighted you're with us. The question is, the state legislature wants a raise. You say they deserve a raise, and so do your commissioners, and probably you. But In the past, I admired your holding out to say, okay, but then you have to do what the U.S. Congress does, no business on the outside, because we know that's the basis of corruption. So you've changed your mind. How come?
No. The pay commission, I've not changed my mind. The first, I do believe they deserve a raise, as I've said repeatedly.
Right.
I do believe there should be reforms. I do believe there should be a banning of outside income, like the Congress, like the New York City Council, because I do believe that's a fundamental conflict.
Yes, but last time, I'm sorry to interrupt, but last time you said no deal. And your commission, which let's face it, is a fairly handpicked commission, said no deal unless you ban this outside income, which ought to be done. This time you're not saying that.
Oh, no, I am saying that. And the legislation has performance as one of the criteria for the raise. It says on the criteria that the commissioners must follow. It talks about performance of the legislature. It talks about timely passage of the budget. It talks about reforms. And I've said quite often to the publicly, and I'm sure the members of the commission have heard my opinion, that, yes, there should be a raise, and, yes, there should be reforms.
Yeah, but they're going to do what you tell them. You know it. I know it.
Comptroller DiNapoli has said publicly he believes there should be a ban on outside income. He's right. One of the commissioners.
Yes, he is.
And then it's Carl McCall, Bill Thompson, and Scott Stringer, the New York City commissioner. So it's up to them. They have to do a report by December 10th, and then the legislature would have to act by the end of the year to stop their report from becoming law. But I hope and I expect that the commission is responsible, and I would support them doing a pay raise with the reforms.
Well, let's go to another subject. I want to talk about you and a potential competition between you and Senator Gillibrand. Now, in my opinion, both of you are looking at the presidency as a possibility. You're not going to agree to that. But okay, that's what I think. Now, you know, and the old joke is that the worst place you want to be is between Chuck Schumer and a microphone. But I don't know. If I were trying to say the worst place to be with you, it might be between you and the presidency. So now Senator Gillibrand may be there. But that presents a problem because you don't want to fight with her, right?
Senator Gillibrand is a longtime friend of mine. We worked together at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. She came down, did a great job in the council's office. So we're personal friends. I'm a big fan of hers. There is no conflict. We work together very well.
Well, what if you both want to be president?
I want to be governor, though.
Oh, well. You want to be governor until you run for president.
That's your theory, Alan. That's
yes,
your
it
theory.
Is. Yes, it is.
And that's your theory on Senator Gillibrand, who says she wants to be senator, right?
Well, she says she's looking at it. I think she's a slightly bit more honest about it than you are, because you keep saying.
Okay. Because... Well, that's your theory.
Yes, it is. Okay.
My theory is I'm shoveling snow as the governor of the state is supposed to be.
I got it. Okay, so single payer health in New York, it would double, right? If you did it in New York, it would double the tax rate. I suppose there have been many estimates. What do you think? Are you going to do it?
I think it is the right concept. I think it is the right direction. I think it is more feasible on a national level. States have looked at trying to do it, Vermont, California, et cetera. None of them could come up with a way to essentially finance the transition cost, right? Because you're going from one healthcare system to another. And that's where the doubling of the state budget comes in. Look, I don't think anybody would support it if you had to double the taxes, but I think everybody supports the goal.
Okay. So I take it there's a period there. So I wanted to develop that a little bit more. Now, I don't want you to get angry at me, because the last thing I want is you angry at me. But he, and that's never happened. But here's the question. If you were, this is just hypothetical. Okay, you ready for hypothetical?
Yes, I'm ready for the hypothetical. I don't get angry. It's without purpose, and age is one.
Okay, so hypothetically, if you were the president of the United States, got it? This is hypothetically. I'm not trying to get you to commit anything. But if you were the president of the United States, would you be for Medicare for all?
Oh, look, single payer, Medicare for all. There is no doubt that that's the direction we have to move. And as a nation, it is much easier to transition than as an individual state. By the way, as an individual state, to do it, you have to get a federal Medicaid waiver that would allow us to use our federal Medicaid in a way that the law does not now allow, which this administration would not do. This president would sooner become a flaming hair liberal than give us a Medicaid waiver to go to single payer. So it's almost impossible to see the federal government doing that. But I believe in the goal, and I believe in the direction. There is no doubt.
I think
it's going to be a big issue in the presidential, and it should be.
I like the metaphor or the allusion to the flaming hair liberal.
It's flaming hair liberal.
Flaming hair liberal.
I'm going to leave it right like that because I like it too.
Okay, let's start. Let's talk about today's editorial in the Albany Times Union that says the New York Attorney General should have greater investigatory powers to look into corruption in state government, which you, sir, supported as the Attorney General. So what do you think now, especially since you have an attorney general who is, you know, fairly close to you in Tish James?
The attorney general is in many ways the greatest job in state government. I loved being attorney general. It's the greatest opportunity to just do good affirmative things. You have some legal constitutional responsibilities, defense of the state, et cetera. But it's really a great place to do affirmative things without having to worry about things like snowstorms and Amazon. This AG I'm very excited about. People underestimate, I think, Tish James and the legal quality she's going to bring to the office. She also knows the problems that people are facing in a way many people don't appreciate. So I'm very excited about Tish as the Attorney General. I'm very excited about working with her. On the corruption issues, the Attorney General can be a very powerful vehicle. And I didn't have the greatest relationship with the governor when I was an Attorney General. The governor was Elliot Spitzer. And I think it's fair to say we had a mixed relationship. But I'm going to have a very, I think very highly of Tish James. And any way I can support her, I will. And I think the AG can be a very big player in fixing corruption. I think, however, the best solution is first a legislative solution. The banning of outside income, Alan, it will be a game changer.
It would, yeah.
I was speaking to someone the other day. I remember going back to Stanley Fink's days when I was a 20-something sitting in the conference room listening to my father go back and forth with Stanley Fink, God rest both their souls, on what should actually happen with the legislature and how it's an inherent conflict if they're in a law firm or a business consultant, et cetera. And that's been now 40 years, 50 years. So I think the pay commission's opportunity, ethics reforms that we can do in January, the LLC loophole, I think these would be fundamental legislative solutions that will really get ahead of the corruption issue. So you don't have to worry about catching it because you're preventing it.
Okay, fine. But this James thing is one of the raps on her during the election was that she was your candidate and that she's not going to really look at the whole picture, that she's going to, you know, be too friendly with you.
She was not my candidate. I don't think I had 3 conversations with her before she ran. That might be slightly over-dramatized. But she is not my candidate before this race, given the options in this race. You know, you had a lot of good options. I thought Sean Patrick Maloney is a great public servant, had a lot of talent, but I think, and he's a friend, and I think he has a bright future. But I thought in this race, Tish James was my choice. But there's no pre-existing relationship that is going to suggest anything other than at this time, in this moment, I endorsed her as a stronger candidate.
Now, I don't want to tick you off. That's the last thing I ever want to do. But one of the black marks on your record so far is the disbanding of the Moreland Act Commission. You had an attorney general who was going along with you, Scheiderman, and who co-created that. Should we have a Moreland Act Commission again? And this time, would you let it go?
The Moreland Act Commission, the fundamental misunderstanding there was the Moreland Act Commission was impaneled because we couldn't achieve reforms that I was trying to get the legislature to enact. I said publicly many times,
yes, you did,
you have to do XYZ or I'm going to do a Moreland Commission. They wouldn't do XYZ.
And what were the XYZ very quickly, Governor?
They were basic ethics reforms, disclosure of outside income for conflicts reviews, J-Corp jurisdiction.
Okay.
And they wouldn't do it. I impaneled Moreland. We went through a very painful period where the Moreland was highly disruptive to the legislature. The legislature came back and passed XYZ. I said, if you pass XYZ, I will terminate the Moreland Commission.
Yeah, but some people thought that the Moreland Act Commission was getting to the meat of things, and that's when they got KO'd.
Yeah, I know. That is a theory again. I don't know where they get that theory from. I don't know where the facts are on that theory. It's not the reality of the situation. But yes, people said, oh, I think we should keep this going forever. That's not what I had done. What I had done was the Moreland Commission because I wanted to accomplish these reforms. You take your family on vacation to Florida and say we're going for 5 days. They get there. They say, oh, you know what? I'd like to move here. Okay, but that's not why I brought us here. I brought us here for 5 days for a vacation. Well, we want to stay forever. That's a different situation. Now, you can also, I can impanel a Moreland Commission at any given moment. It's not that because you stop one Moreland Commission, you can't start another. I can start a Moreland Commission today if I wanted to.
Well, Governor, I'm getting the signal from Action Central that I have overstayed my welcome here and that they have to move on with other programming, but you've been very generous with your time. I mean, that's a half an hour of your time, and I know what that's worth on a day like today, so I thank you very much for being with us.
No, it was my pleasure. Give me a break from shoveling the snow. You have a good day, Alan. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
And thank you, Alan and Governor Cuomo. We'll take a quick break here. This is the Roundtable on WAMC.